We're going to start with a couple of public hearings. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 430. That's Kyle. Kyle, if you could come up here and give us a quick briefing.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 430 is a bill that would create a refundable income tax credit. The credit is equal to 10% of the retail value of a shipping container, and these shipping containers are required to be donated to a public entity for the use of storing emergency supplies within 1,000 feet of the public building. It does require the taxpayer that's claiming the credit to maintain records sufficient to prove their eligibility of the credit, and the credit would be applicable in tax years 2019 through 2024.
Senator Frederick, this is your bill. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. I'm also here for 431 as well, so in case you're interested.
Hi.
Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lou Frederick. I'm Senator from District 22, North and Northeast Portland. And today it's commonplace in Oregon to speak of emergency preparedness and plans for disaster relief as we think about the aftermath of what many of us refer to as the big one. We are tragically underprepared for more localized emergencies, let alone the shifting of a subduction zone. Frankly, everybody talks about emergency preparedness, but we have been slow to act. Some of the most vulnerable Oregonians are our students, whether it's a fumes leak at Harriet Tubman Middle School, Elementary School or Middle School, or a facade collapse at Malala Union High School. These events portray the inadequacy of external resources that could be used to keep our children safe and to save lives. Much of the emergency preparedness for schools is centered on safely removing students from buildings. However, there are a few examples of schools that provide emergency caches outside of the building, except for the model we find now in Lincoln County, where they house emergency supplies in shipping containers. Senate Bill 430 aims to increase the availability of these shipping containers to public schools at no cost to the schools. I propose a tax credit that is 10% of the retail value of the shipping containers. This shipping container credit will serve as an incentive for owners to donate containers to be used as emergency caches outside of the schools throughout the state. This bill does not mandate that schools accept shipping containers to be used as emergency caches. It does not detail what should be kept in the caches, nor how they should be maintained. Lincoln County School District's model serves as a good example of how the containers can be put to use. There are several things I want to make clear again. Senate Bill 430 in no way mandates the kinds of supplies that schools keep in the containers, and I do not propose that the state directly pay for the items placed in the containers. We will leave this up to the local sites as they've done in Lincoln County based on what they need in those particular spaces. Secondly, it's a faulty assumption that a donated shipping container must be depreciated. Each school could decide whether they want to accept a donation. No one is forcing schools to take a container in poor condition. And finally, the logistics of who is delivering the shipping container will be left up to the donor and the site. I do not think the state, through this proposal, should get into the nitty-gritty of how we put these containers on sites. There are 1,300 public schools in Oregon, and a tax credit that is 10% of the retail value of the containers will have, I believe, a minimal fiscal impact on the state. What we have to consider is the value of the need to prepare for an emergency compared to the relatively small cost. Senate Bill 430 represents one small step in the right direction to protect our students. And I think this is an approach that we can take that would be helpful.
I do have a question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I was just looking at New York's standards for shipping containers as storage facilities by school districts. And they have a bunch of pretty thoughtful suggestions. Is it your thought that you would impose this, the obligation of making, for example, many of them are airtight, you close the door, people can't get out, wouldn't want those around schools, so you'd have to have something that would go along with them to call out the obvious, I suppose. But is your thought that this tax credit would be given without regard to that type of concern?
Chair Hess, Senator Binns, I think that what we're talking about is the ability for school districts to decide which ones they want to accept and how they would set that up. I'm not suggesting that we decide that for them. They've gone through quite a bit to try to make sure that that's the case in New York. I'm leaving it up to the district. Your district is not going to be concerned so much about a tsunami coming in. But you may, at least I don't think so. I hope not, anyway. But because that would be one heck of a tsunami. But I think that, you know, the ability to have blankets and other things stored in a particular place in a way. But there's also a concern that we've had with some containers that have been kept off-site of schools that had radio devices, and the concern that the security for those. We need to be able, I would encourage that each school district and sometimes each school needs to understand what's the best kind of container that they would have. We're not going to get into what they need to be, what needs to be in that container, or the condition or the security aspects of it until the school gets a chance to decide on that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. So to show you how, I hate to say boring, one of my previous committee meetings was, I did look at the cost of a shipping container and found out that it was somewhere between $2,500 and $4,000. And so this would be 10% of that amount, or $250 or $400 for the credit.
Right.
At least if that's the amount they ended up paying. Any idea of the demand for this type of device?
In my conversations with school districts and principals and some neighborhood associations, there are folks who would like to see something on their site or close by, because once you get the children out of the building, you want to have some place that they can work on, as well as how the neighborhood might deal with things. When we have a significant disaster in Portland, for instance, I think we're going to need to have communication capabilities, something outside a building like a school, not just inside. We have people collecting information or to go, what do they call them, get and go kinds of packets, go bags. On the coast, I have some friends of mine have their packs and boots and everything right next to the door, ready to go, because they know that they're going to need that. We're going to need some things outside public buildings as well, in my view.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Kyle, did you mention this came from another committee, right?
Yeah. So just you know, colleagues, Lincoln County has been the leader on this particular concept, and Senator Frederick kind of picked it up and has run with it for the rest of the state, and he's quite familiar with it. And in Lincoln County, what transpired is because, you know, we've done resilience in schools, but you don't have emergency supplies or a place to store them inside the buildings. And so Lincoln County, who came and made presentations too in support previously to Senator Frederick's proposal here, as they pointed out, they could find, especially in 2008, 2009 timeframe, the downturn, they could find companies who would donate containers, but the cost is about 10% of the value of the container to truck it down there to the school district. So therefore, by getting the credit, therefore the container companies can now, you know, without losing money, deliver excess containers to school districts and places like that. In Lincoln County, as the good senator said, they put them outside in the parking lots, and of course they store the materials in them so that they have the storage that's there, because a lot of these schools have gotten the grants to keep the seismic grants, but there's no place to store that emergency equipment. And once they had the container, the senator, I guess, failed to mention, is that the school district, it was amazing, the local community said, well, now you got a place to store stuff. People started coming forth and said, businesses that said, well, we'll buy you 100 blankets to put in the container. And it became sort of the football story, you build it, they will come. And this is how Lincoln County got all of its schools with all of these containers. But the shortfall is the container companies aren't in Lincoln County, they're in Portland. And so they got to put this on, if you don't know how they move these containers, on a little flatbed with two of them, 220-foot, and they go down and they can place them. But it was the transportation costs for the companies that were willing to donate them to go to the school districts and drop them off. And that's sort of landing on this spot. Both Senator Frederick came up independently and Lincoln County came up with the ideas of, okay, this is sort of the cost to move these containers down there. It was really remarkable how the county came to do this down in Lincoln County.
Senator Senator Boquist, I found it remarkable that the coordination, the collaboration within the community. You're talking about blankets, but others brought forward shovels and picks and other because you never know what's collapsed and how you can support that kind of thing.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. That's an interesting idea. So since 3/4 of my district is Portland and 1/4 is Clackamas, and I know you have all of Portland, so for us, for Portland Public Schools, you know, we have 90-some schools. So how does it work where, like at Cleveland, Cleveland High School, there would be no place to put something, you know what I mean? Like those kind of situations, would it be that some would be eligible or not, and that would be just the way that it is kind of thing?
Well, I unfortunately looked at this, a bit of this, when I was working for the Portland Public Schools as a director of public information. At Cleveland, for instance, you could conceivably put it on the parking lot on on the west side of of 26th. You could put a container there. It would take up a couple of parking spaces, which many of the teachers would be upset about, but I think that it would still be worth it. There are other places around, often around near schools. Wouldn't have to be on the school grounds necessarily, but you can find sometimes places that are close enough by that you could potentially put a container. And you don't have to have the same size container. It doesn't have to be one of the super large ones. It can be just a small one, depending on what you think you're going to need in the community.
Senator Benz.
Chair, I hesitate to bring this up, but somewhere in the past, I vaguely remember the land use planning challenges that go with siting quasi-permanently a shipping container wherever you might want to put it.
Right.
And rather than go down that trail, I'll just say, I'm glad we're not stuck with that problem. All we're talking about is the tax credit. But, yeah.
Well, thank you, Senator Hess, Senator Benz. I'm glad we're not going to try to go down that track either. But I think it's something we need to be aware of, because we've had, unfortunately, folks, just down the street from me, I live just off of Tillamook, just down the street from me, we had several shipping containers that had been sitting in an empty lot for the last 30 years. They've been moved, and now we have a full housing development there. But it was something that we had. That's why those rules were put in place, because we had folks who were not doing the right thing. This is a different situation.
Senator Frederick, why at 10%?
Not 50%
or 5%.
Well, the 10%, Senator Boquist, I think, hit upon it very clearly. The 10% was sort of a cost that for shipping it, for moving it, they were able to basically write off that cost of transporting those to different places. That's what we found in Lincoln County, Lincoln City. It took that because the shipping containers are in the Portland area primarily, and it would take that much to get them to Bend, to other places. So this was just the cost. This was an approach we thought would take.
Okay, and we don't have a revenue cost estimated yet.
No.
So, all right, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Do you want me to stay? What do you want me to do here?
Stand.
Here's the other bill.
If you stand down, we take another witness on this bill.
Cool.
Marsha Kelly.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Benz, members of the committee, I'm Marsha Kelly from the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition, following revenue in the building since 2001 when I started lobbying for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. This bill is a nice idea. I think that the mission could get accomplished in different ways. Since 1990, the tax credits and deferrals that have been passed by this legislature in the next biennium will cost 700 and $90,600 if you discount the property tax ones where they say it's less than $100,000. With school districts getting about 41% of the property tax across the state, that would be $324 million that the school districts might be able to use to make their buildings more resilient in emergencies. Corporate taxes deferred in the next biennium will be $227,500,000, and business the pass-through business taxes to individuals would be $400 million. I've taken these figures, just run Excel spreadsheets for the business taxes and those portions out of the tax expenditure report, and I'll at some point have an opportunity to provide a listing of those. I think we need to stop and think before we do tax credits. This is a good idea, but when you start adding them together, they start adding up to real money for the state of Oregon and the schools.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you, Marcia. No one else has signed up to testify on this bill, so I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 430. And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 431. So, Jamie?
Isn't this about special districts?
Yes, it is.
Are you asking a question?
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 431 would create a new set of taxing districts and create urban flood safety and water quality district in portion of Multnomah County with the urban growth boundary adopted by Metro for purposes of managing and improving the levee system, drainage system, and natural areas. Essentially, it would also remove, there's currently a set of taxing districts to manage the levee system, and they are separate. And my understanding from working with Columbia, Levee Ready Columbia, is that it would remove those and create a new district, and the goal would be to separate out the capital infrastructure needed to shore up the levee system from the ongoing maintenance costs, and assess those fees separately.
Okay. Questions or comments? Senator Frederick.
Thank you, Senator Hess. I'm Lou Frederick, again, Senate District 22, North and Northeast Portland. And I happen to have, in much of my district, the largest urban levee system in the state along the Columbia River. It's 27 miles. Between North Portland and Gresham, Fairview and Troutdale, from basically from the confluence of the Willamette River and the Sandy Rivers. The system reduces the risk of flooding for the Portland International Airport, for 750 residents, for 2,500 businesses, and 49,000 jobs. There are three interstate highways in that area, many publicly owned assets, including the second largest source of drinking water, and the Portland Air National Guard facility, over 2,000 acres of parks and natural areas, and the drainage districts that manage the system were established in 1917, when the area was primarily farmland owned by less than a dozen large landowners. That is no longer the case. There are only a couple of farms left in that area, and it's a major industrial and residential corridor. Senate Bill 431 establishes a more modern approach to managing the system. It affects the four drainage districts that manage the levee system in urban Multnomah County. No other drainage districts in the states will be impacted by the bill. It allows the district board to establish a revenue structure that would be more equitably spreading costs based on services and benefits received. It'll allow the district to continue to consider environmental benefits along with flood safety. And it means that a more comprehensive, holistic approach can be taken to the management of the levee and the drainage system along the lower Columbia. People have been working quite a bit to satisfy some of the concerns that other folks have had. I think we've come to a good agreement with the community and with the landowners and with the folks who are involved in any sort of governing of this area. So I encourage you to look at it, and I hope you'll improve it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, we've got a list of people who want to talk about it. Thank you, sir.
Good deal. Thanks.
Jules Bailey. In fact, I'll call a couple of you up. Jules, Jeff Condit, and Bob Salinger.
How are you?
Chair Hess, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jules Bailey, and I'm here as a private citizen and volunteer as the convener for Levy Ready Columbia, a fun role that I've had for about 5 years now, dating back to when I used to be an elected official, and had the opportunity back when I was a state rep to serve with Senator Riley and Senator Bence on junior varsity revenue over in the back. So congratulations, gentlemen, on making it to the varsity team. This bill, Senate Bill 431, comes to you with the unanimous recommendation of the Senate Environment and Natural Resources Committee. I'm very pleased that it ended up here in revenue because it needs some adult supervision. And we're here to just talk to you a little bit about what this bill does and why we think it is critical for the region. So Levy Ready Columbia and the levy system, this is really an issue of statewide significance, but of regional importance. And it's one of the reasons why the legislature has been asked to take it up. Levy Ready Columbia is a partnership of over 20 organizations that are committed to a collaborative approach on the floodplain management and modernizing the 27-mile levee system that runs across the Columbia River from North Portland through Troutdale. And as you might imagine, there are a number of jurisdictions and different community groups that operate there. It's Levy Ready Columbia is made up of public agencies, community members, private entities, as well as nonprofits and environmental representatives. And we've been working on this for quite a while. The challenge really is that we have an aging levee system. And that aging levee system protects incredibly important assets. Those assets include, obviously, the Portland Airport and all of our port infrastructure and associated infrastructure with that. But there's also $16 billion in annual economic activity and revenue to the state that's behind those levies. 10% of all the jobs in Multnomah County are behind that levy, all the manufacturing jobs, and 7,500 residents and over 59,000 employees, including enormous environmental assets and habitat as well. So this is an important area for us economically, environmentally, and frankly, just for the health and safety of our community. Following Hurricane Katrina in 2005, the federal entities that oversee flood protection, FEMA and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, increased their standards, and we have become in danger of losing our accreditation of our flood safety system. And that is important because if we lose our accreditation, which could happen at any moment, they could choose to remap us. It would be enormously expensive for entities behind that district to purchase flood insurance. It'd be very difficult to purchase flood insurance. We'd lose federal help in the event of a flood disaster. It would generally just be bad and put those assets at significant risk in addition to the life and safety risks. FEMA has essentially granted us a reprieve while we're working on this, but we are in danger of that accreditation, and they have only granted us a reprieve because we're working in good faith to solve this this issue. So LRC originally formed to help the four drainage districts responsible for operating the levees meet these new federal safety standards. And these aren't academic. While we remember the tragedy of Vanport and what happened in 1948 in these floods, there's also current flooding issues. Just last year, we would have had the runway for the airport underwater twice during flood events last year, but for these levees. LRC has worked to really understand what needs to be done from a technical perspective to make sure that these levees are recertified, to do the engineering and analysis work, and then to build a financial structure in order to accomplish it. And so what we know is that there's about $43 million in immediate repairs and upgrades that are needed, and really about $115 million to $200 million that would be needed to fully modernize the system. That's a lot of money. And frankly, it is too much money for an outdated and antiquated special district structure. And the reality is that the people that are living behind that levee and in those drainage districts can't afford to take on all of the costs themselves and, in addition, maintain it into the future. And frankly, they shouldn't have to, because it is an area that contains assets that are valuable to the entire metro area. And so one of the principles that we've been working on in coming up with a governance and funding structure is one of fairness. And that fairness says that somebody like me that lives at 500 feet in Multnomah Village, several miles south, and who uses the airport and benefits from the economic activity that's behind the levy ought to be paying in to that system in order to help maintain it. And at that point, many hands make light work, and we can keep this system upgraded and accredited into the future. In addition, there's governance issues that have become challenging for the drainage districts, and their financial tools would create issues with compression because they're subject to Measure 5 tax provisions. So as we embarked on creating this governance structure, we had to get creative, essentially. And to do that, and Jeff Condit will walk you through the bill, we had all of these groups come together to figure out what the right governance structure would be. And we did a lot of hard work over several years. And I'm pleased to say that we've achieved consensus on what the new entity looks like. I frankly wasn't sure that that was going to be possible. But through a lot of hard work from the people that are around the table that have understood the importance of this issue, we've reached consensus. What you don't see in this bill is a specific funding structure, because that is left up to the district that will be formed, first through an interim board and later through elections and appointments into a permanent board. That board will be tasked with creating the funding structure that will align with the upgrades that are needed and the ongoing maintenance of this. What we do know is that this, the way this district is structured, is it will allow for a utility fee that will avoid those effects of compression and will be structured in a way that those who pay the fee most directly benefit from the flood protection and the levy system. In addition, it will allow for other revenue mechanisms like a GO bond that would be applied in all of the urban growth boundary within Multnomah County that would allow for everybody to chip into some of the more major capital upgrades. The economic analysis that's been done on this bill have shown that the majority of the benefits do accrue to those who are behind the levy. And so the way that this district is structured, both through representation and through potential assessment, is to ensure that those people are best represented in the governance structure who will pay the most into the system. And the entire effort is predicated on the idea that we must match cost to benefit. So you have a fairly lengthy and technical bill in front of you. Jeff will walk through some of it, but we're pleased to take any questions here, and we're very glad that LRO and your committee are diving into the details of this bill. Thank you.
Go ahead, I think I had to ask a question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Condit. I'm an attorney at Miller, Nash, Graham & Dunn, and we represent the Multnomah County Drainage District. We've had some discussion of the overall structure of the bill, but the intent is to take four districts whose governance structures were created in the early 20th century and convert them into one larger district with a single governance structure that has some more modern and up-to-date methods of financing and the powers and authority to be able to carry that out, which is not the case with the current structure. So as Jules mentioned, right now the drainage districts are run by elected boards, elected by the landowners, and they achieve their revenue by assessing those landowners on a per acre basis. And that makes a lot of sense when you're assessing farmland for removing water so they can grow crops, but it's not very equitable when you're talking about raising revenue for the levies, and it doesn't quite frankly raise enough revenue to accomplish the things that Jules was talking about. So that's the overall structure. We have a We have an interim board and a permanent board. The reason for that is we have a whole bunch of stakeholders, as Jules mentioned, that have been working on this for the last 5 years that have already dived deep into this. And so the purpose of the interim board would be get the new new district up and running and then turn it over to a permanent board once they had all those financing tools in place. The permanent board will be primarily elected, but some members will be appointed by the governor based upon expertise. The two major financing methods, since this is the revenue committee, would be setting up a utility for the sort of the stormwater and maintenance part of their role, and then giving the authority to issue GO bonds for the major capital improvements. GO bonds, like GO bonds in school districts and cities, would have to be referred to the voters and have it be voted on for the districts to be able to levy those taxes and issue those bonds. The district has more specifically directed powers to flood control, and also the powers allow it to do some environmental remediation and improvements. Back in 1917, no one thought about green infrastructure as a way to deal with flood control, and now it's an important tool in the toolbox. The current districts arguably don't have that authority, and this would grant that authority. Districts would have the authority to, or the new district would have eminent domain authority. That is the same authority as the current districts have, primarily to acquire easements along the levee for flood control. I note that, at least in my 8 years of representing the districts, they have never exercised that authority, but they have to have that authority in order to be a federal partner under the FEMA and CORE regulations. The new district would still have to comply with all the regulations that are applicable to anybody who would be doing work out in that area. That was a concern of some of our stakeholder partners, so that's built into the bill. There is a process at the end, or the process once it's up and running, for dissolving the existing four districts and then transferring their authority and assets over to the new district. And that's basically the bill in a nutshell. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Hess, Vice Chair Benson, members of the committee. My name is Bob Salinger. I'm the Conservation Director for the Audubon Society of Portland, and we are pleased to be here today to support this bill. We were a stakeholder on this stakeholder group since its inception. A tremendous amount of hard work has gone into this. We participated because we felt this was a real opportunity to not only shore up the levees, but also to take a modern approach to water management in this area. We had some concerns with the original bill that we put on the record along with some other groups. We're really pleased to say that those have all been resolved at this point. And we appreciate the work of Jules, Evan Mitchell, Stephanie Halleck, and the whole committee. They spent many, many hours working through the fine details of this bill to get it right. A tremendous amount of work in the last couple of months has resolved those issues and allowed us to be here today and move from a position of concern to very strong support. What we're excited about in this bill is that the language makes it clear that the mission includes watershed health, climate resilience, and environmental justice. It sets the stage for a 21st century approach to flood management that moves beyond simple structural barriers, kind of the 1920s, 30s, 50s approach, to actually integrating green infrastructure and looking at the natural hydrology of the landscape. It includes thinking about the inequities that have been created by the way that we've managed water on the landscape historically, who's been displaced, who's benefited, and who's borne the burdens. And it sets the stage for addressing the biggest challenge of the 21st century, which is climate change. How do we do this in a way that really prepares us for the changes that are coming? So we think this bill gets it right. It's a product of a lot of work, a lot of compromise. We would really urge that you move it forward in this session. There's a lot of work ahead for this group. This only gets us part of the way there, but the sooner that we get this stage resolved, get the new structure in place, allows us to move on to do the work that's coming ahead. Also, I think we should take advantage of this moment where we all have come together. It took a long time to get everybody on the same page. Everybody has reached consensus. Let's take advantage of that, propel this bill forward, and move this group together forward into the next phase. So thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Question on the financial tools. You have a vote. I mean, the people who are being assessed, the ratepayers, if you will, if there's a utility. So who votes to make this happen? Would it be a bigger group than the ratepayers? And if so, how will that work?
There are two major revenue parts to this bill. The first is the utility fee. That can be voted on and approved by the board. And it's envisioned that that will apply to the managed floodplain area, the area behind the levees that's protected from the flood. The boundaries of that area, how that's going to be done, all of that is a future discussion from the new board to put in place. But the committee did do significant vetting over the last 3 years about this model and think it can work and more equitably spread that cost to the people who are benefiting than the current per acre assessment. The second part is GO bond, and that would be the voters of the entire district boundaries, which is the urban growth boundary in Multnomah County, would vote on that. And the district would have to make the case to the voters, like any other taxing district, to get that approved. And if approved, then they could issue general obligation bonds to build capital infrastructure. And that would be primarily the levee systems, pump stations, those kinds of capital improvements.
That would be all of the voters in Multnomah County within the urban growth boundary.
Correct.
Even though the benefit would be for this
right
sort of narrow district.
Chair Hess, the governance structure also addresses that issue. So the way that the permanent board is set up, you have 9 members of the permanent board, 5 elected members and 4 appointed members. The appointed members are because we wanted to make sure there were people with specific expertise on that board and include environmental representatives and the port and experts in flood control. Of the 5 elected representatives, 4 of them must be represented either by a business or as a landowner or a resident of the managed floodplain. Now, they will be voted on by the entire jurisdiction, but they have to be from that area because those people do pay more. And so they'll have 4 of the 5 elected seats, with a 5th seat that will be elected at large from the entire area. And that's to make sure that the representation of those that are making this decision is overwhelmingly representative of those that will be paying into the cost. To give you a sense of the cost, and I want to be very, very clear and just reiterate again, this bill does not set up a utility fee or a GO bond. It simply sets up an interim board and the legal structure that will then move towards elections that will then set up utility fees and a GO bond. But in the modeling that we've done with FCS Group, a private consultant that we've done a lot of work with, potential amounts could be in the range of, right now you have people within the managed floodplain paying $4 to $6 a month already into their drainage district. If they were to pay both a utility fee and a GO bond, it might look more like $5 to $8 a month. When you're talking about amounts of, for the GO bond outside the managed floodplain, you're looking at amounts of around 90 cents a month, or about less than $11 a year. So I don't want to say that any amount of tax revenue is insignificant. There are a lot of families for whom that's a significant amount of money. But I wanted to at least give you a sense of scope of what the analysis is that would be needed in order to accomplish this. But again, that's not set up in this bill. That would be accomplished by the interim board and the permanent board.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at Section 25 and 26, and I was just curious, can you explain why we have them? 25 first.
These are provisions, enforcement provisions that carry over from the current drainage district statute. They provide authority to enforce against people who dump things in the levee, who are into the drainage system, who maintain any kind of impediment there that impedes water flow. That is power that the current drainage districts have, and it carries forward in the new bill. And the drainage districts felt very strongly that they needed to have that authority, if only to be able to use it to convince people to do the right thing.
On line 3, I think, of the following page, it gives a any other person injured by a violation of section 25. What does that mean? Any other person injured by? So I just want to know, this is a private cause of action to do something, and I just want to know, what, for the purpose of the record, I would like you to explain what that's supposed to be doing.
Sure. So if somebody were to dump pollution into the waterway or obstruct it and cause flooding, and a third party was damaged from that, this would give that person a cause of action against the violator.
Correct.
And again, that's existing drainage district authority.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The issue is there has to be specific damage to the person as opposed to someone driving by and seeing the pollution and saying, I'm damaged by the virtue of just seeing it. What you're saying is you got to be hurt.
Correct.
You have owned land by it or something.
Correct.
Have a houseboat sitting in the whatever. You've got to be personally damaged.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair, may I comment for a moment? I will mention, too, that there are some very minor technical amendments that will be coming in this committee to this bill. Since it left the previous committee, we've discovered just some word changes here and there and some technical issues that need to get cleaned up, and it's an opportunity to do it here. So you will see that hopefully coming quite soon.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we turn. Senator Benz. The so-called managed floodplain, is that the existing districts put together, or is it something greater than that?
It's envisioned to be established by the new board. They would pick the boundaries of that. It would be larger than the existing district's boundaries, but not significantly larger. It would basically be the areas within behind the levee that are subject to flooding.
And Chair Hass, Senator Benz, we've worked very closely with Dogami and others to establish technical considerations about how about risk assessment in developing this proposal. One of the challenges has been that some of these areas don't exist in definition already, and so we have to create ways for the district to be able to designate those and define those.
Thank you. The concept of the benefit of this device and the measure of it is of interest to me. For example, the Port of Portland's benefit may be far greater than someone who owns a small farm just by virtue of the activities going on the land. Yet, it would seem that they would both pay the same. Is there some sort of? Well, I say it would seem. Perhaps I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm hopefully wrong.
I think that would be, those differences would be taken into account when they set the rates, the utility rates. The Port of Portland obviously has probably the most impervious surface in the entire area, and stormwater rates are typically based upon that. So the way that the new fee will be charged should account for those differences in an equitable manner. That's the intent.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So the drainage districts I have represented in the past had some sort of measure of the value of drainage. This is also the value of preventing flooding. So there's quite a bit of work to be done in that space, I'm guessing.
There is, Senator.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
So there is still Section 18 in this legislation, which allows the district to impose ad valorem property taxes.
Correct, Senator Riley. They would impose ad valorem property taxes if the voters passed a bond levy to repay the debt on the bonds. That's the way it works for every jurisdiction has the authority to issue GO bonds. So they do have to have the authority to issue, to levy ad valorem property taxes to pay the bonds. The district no longer has the authority. In the original several drafts, we gave the districts the authority to adopt a permanent rate limit and to do local option levies. We removed those methods of taxation because of concerns about compression and the way that would affect other taxing districts. So the only ad valorem property tax authority that the districts have now is to ask the voters to approve a GO bond levy or a GO bond measure and then levy taxes to pay it off.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Nolan Young. Mickey Schultz.
Good morning, Chair House, committee members. My name is Corky Collier. I'm on the Board of Supervisors for the Multnomah County Drainage District, and I'm also Executive Director of the Columbia Corridor Association. The Columbia Corridor is essentially the same area as this drainage district that would be created in SB 431. It's Oregon's largest economic corridor, but it wasn't always that way. A century ago, it was considered to be a massive park. That didn't happen. Instead, it became farmland. The farmers built up dikes and levees to keep their fields a bit drier. And eventually, industrial businesses moved into the area and continued to invest in the levee system alongside their infrastructure business needs. Today, our levees protect $7.4 billion worth of infrastructure. That's a lot of buildings, a lot of pipelines, two interstate highways, two intercontinental railroads, an international airport. It's 2,500 businesses, including homegrown companies like Leatherman Tools, Danner Boots, Columbia Steel, Oregon Food Bank. It's the export hub of the state. Whether it's air freighting Intel chips and Nike shoe parts through PDX, shipping out Oregon farm products from the port, or trucking out Leatherman Tools. It has eight building trade training centers located behind the levees, including the Northwest College of Construction, the Pacific Northwest Council of Carpenters Institute, the National Electrical Contractors Association, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. The levees protect a manufacturing sector that's growing twice as fast as our overall economy. Being mostly traded sector, this translates to new cash for our state. The 2,500 businesses behind those levees create $16 billion worth of economic activity, which sounded a lot more impressive before Jules mentioned that. It also creates 59,000 jobs, but not just any jobs. These are family wage jobs. Portland's industrial sector employs more people of color and non-four-year degree college in middle wage jobs than any other sector. And half of those are in the Columbia Corridor with an average wage of $50,000. So when you consider the importance of a new governance structure for our levee system, please do consider the 16 million passengers at PDX, the backup drinking water supply for the Portland area, the goods movement for farmers and craftsmen across the state. But please remember, above all, the faces of Oregon's middle class, because this is where they thrive. Thank you.
Chair Haas and the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill, which the City of Fairview, which I represent as the city administrator, strongly supports. Fairview is located in eastern Multnomah County, straddling I-84, and with its northern boundary being the Columbia River and the levee that protects a major part of Fairview. Fairview is the smallest of the four cities that are located within the managed floodplain, but has probably the highest percent of population that is within that that floodplain. Approximately 25% of our residents live within that managed floodplain. In addition, our primary water well is also located within the managed floodplain. if the levees failed and that area was flooded, it would have devastating impact on the residents who lived in it, and the residents of the entire community as it affected our as it affects our water system. In addition, if the levee is not reaccredited, it will have an impact upon those who own property within the managed floodplain. They will lose economic value as it becomes difficult for them to gain flood insurance. If the if indeed we do reaccreditate and proceed with the improvements but do not create a new source of funding, it would be devastating on those, again, who lived in the areas. They had to bear the entire cost of the efforts to put those improvements in. Fairview has been engaged in this activity since 2013. We have financially contributed. The staff and elected officials have been involved. At one time, I estimated that I was spending approximately 10% of my time working on this issue because it was that important to the community. We feel that the bill as crafted is the best solution. A lot of hard work has went into it. It creates a two-tier structure on the with an interim board and a permanent board that we feel helps us work through the final issues and come up with a solution that spreads the benefit where the spreads the cost where the benefit is derived. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you for having us here today. My name is Nikki Schultz. I'm a board member on the Multnomah County Drainage District. I'm also a resident of the managed floodplain. I live in the Interlochen community, which is borders Fairview, not in Fairview, but borders Fairview. And I'm also a civil engineer on the faculty of the University of Portland. And what I want to talk about is why we need to modernize the governance structure and some of the implications of working with four boards in one floodplain. So the current drainage districts are, we have four separate drainage districts. There's PIN 1, PIN 2, Multnomah County Drainage District, and the Sandy Drainage Improvement Company. Each of those districts have four boards, and they make up what we're referring to as the Columbia Corridor, which is the entire, almost the entirety of the managed floodplain. The reason we have four boards is because they were all formed around the turn of the previous century, around 1918, 1920, earlier than that. And drainage districts like this were being formed all over the country at the time, and they were primarily formed by farmers to protect farmland with associated funding for those sorts of things. Those governance structures have persisted into the current time. So now we don't have farms, but well, there are farms, but we are not primarily farmland behind this levee system. So what's the implication of having four boards? The way we operate right now, the four boards meet. We do manage the system or the floodplain, the levee system as one managed floodplain, one system. The Multnomah County Drainage District does the operations and maintenance for all four boards. But all four boards still need to meet. So each board meets monthly. In addition to that, we meet as a group of four boards. So we've got five people on the Multnomah County Drainage District board. Each of the other three boards has either four or five members. So now we've got, I think, 16 or 17 folks in the room when we're meeting as a full four board meeting, which we do about once a month. So I have to meet once for my board and again for the four board meeting. Our staff has to manage those meetings, those five now board meetings a month. Right? That's a significant amount of time. It's really inefficient. Our staff is doing operations and maintenance not only for the Multnomah County Drainage District, but for Pin 1 and for Pin 2. So if a pump goes out in Pin 2, the Pin 2 board needs to approve the replacement funding or how they're going to deal with that failure. And then they bring it to our operations and maintenance staff, which are really overseen by us. It's a very archaic and cumbersome system that doesn't work today. Well, I won't say it doesn't work. We're doing fine, but we're not really able to deal with some of our big issues that we need to be able to tackle for recertification and accreditation of our levee system, which we need to avoid having flood insurance issues come up, and also just general protection of the properties that are behind the levees. So why is coordinating important? It's important for good operation, but I mentioned I'm a civil engineer. In 2005, when Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, which New Orleans has not recovered from, they still don't have the same population or the same economy that they had prior to that event. They lost over 1,000 people. They had nearly $7 billion in direct public infrastructure damage and over $30 billion in total damages from that hurricane. What we do in civil engineering when we have a major failure is we investigate. We try to find out what happened. And so the American Society of Civil Engineers, along with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, went in and did a forensic analysis of what went wrong in Hurricane Katrina and the response. And there were many things that happened, but one of the primary findings was that their governance structure, which is like the governance structure for most of the levee districts throughout the country, was insufficient. So they had 6 levee districts in New Orleans prior to the hurricane. Because they had these 6 independent districts, they didn't coordinate well, and so there were inefficiencies and problems throughout the system that led to the failures. And one of the main findings then was that what we need to do is modernize governance structures. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is currently working with the Multnomah County Drainage District and the other 3 districts in helping us do studies and paying for studies to find out what we need to do for reaccreditation, recertification. But they're working with us because we're working together and we're coordinating and we're working with Levee Ready Columbia. But it's really not a sustainable structure. So we're hoping that you'll help us with this bill to modernize our governance structure so that we can get rid of having 4 separate boards and move into the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Well, we appreciate your thoughtful analysis and advocacy of this bill. We do have a technical amendment, and so we're going to take another swing at this maybe next week or as soon as things come in. So thank you, Senator Riley. You okay? All right. Thanks to you 3 and Jules to your team.
Thank you.
Jamie, do you have any amendments that you were working on for this bill?
I don't, Chair Haas, although I have been talking with the folks from Levee Ready Columbia to discuss the technical questions or concerns, and okay. I think we'll be in touch.
Yeah. Okay, so that clears us out. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 431. That does it for a week, unless you're on the Student Success Committee, which may or may not fire up here at 5:00. So we will adjourn.